Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to our coverage of the British Pacific Fleet. So, well, having resupplied back in Leyte Gulf, the British Pacific Fleet was back off Sakishima on the 4th of May 1945, and as mentioned at the close of the previous video covering this deployment, a force of US Navy escort carriers had attempted to keep up the pressure on the Japanese airfields, but they lacked the numbers, and air operations on the island had recovered to some extent. The increase in Japanese air operations had then been telling, as Enterprise and Intrepid had been damaged off Okinawa and forced to fall back. The USS Shangri-La had arrived to take over to a certain extent, but when you combined the loss of Enterprise and Intrepid services with the previously damaged carriers from the past few weeks, Task Group 58.2 had to be dissolved completely, with the remaining carriers from the group, the Randolph and the Light Carrier Independence, being sent to reinforce the diminished task groups 58.3 and 58.4. But with the escort carriers now allowed to return to Okinawa, more air support for the troops on the ground was available once again. The new launch positions for the British Pacific Fleet placed it a little bit more directly between the Sakishima Islands and Okinawa, which both forced the Japanese attackers to try and find the fleet again, as opposed to just going to the old launch point. And it would also allow for easier interception of any raids that the Japanese launched against US forces, whether they launched from the Sakishima airfields or from Formosa, as those aircraft would use the Sakishima airfields as a navigation point. First blood came in the early dawn when a small number of Japanese aircraft, presumably on the lookout for the British Pacific Fleet, approached, and then promptly fled after one of their Zeros was jumped and shot down by the Combat Air Patrol. Avengers began rolling off the carrier flight decks at 0605, heading for Miyako, while another set of Avengers were then lined up to go after Ishigaki later in the day. As expected, both of the airfields offered stiff anti-aircraft opposition, but the fleet had planned for this in two parts. Firstly, the initial fighter sweeps, which they'd done previously, would be supplemented by sustained fighter sweeps during the bomber offensive to keep the anti-aircraft guns suppressed as best as possible. And secondly, five cruisers supported the two battleships King George V and Howe as they closed on the islands for direct fire. Once the anti-aircraft guns had given away their positions, the two capital ships then engaged in counter-battery fire with their 14-inch guns, under the relatively reasonable assumption that light and medium anti-aircraft installations were probably not hardened against 14-inch high-explosive rounds. One of the crew aboard King George V would later recount, "A turret fired four ranging rounds, all of which we could see strike the island, a tall column of black smoke and dust marking their impact on a distant hill. The three 6-inch gun cruisers ahead of us were an impressive sight, firing rapidly at the island's anti-aircraft installations. However, the necessity to take cover when the 14-inch guns fired quickly overcame any interest I had in watching the cruisers or our own shells striking the island. Anyone on the ADP who could crouched behind the output bulwark or any other shelter on our open platform and concentrated on listening for the ting-ting of the fire gong on the main director, which sat in the middle of the ADP. My action station was at the base of its supporting tower. The director was immediately above me. The fire gong preceded the firing of the 14-inch guns by a second or two, and that was just enough time to crouch down on the deck and shield yourself from the blast of the guns. We were only a few minutes into our bombardment when we lost communication with our spotting aircraft, but in spite of this, the shooting was good. For 50 minutes, the two battleships battered the airfields with their 3/4-ton high-explosive 14-inch shells. Reconnaissance photographs of the target area after the bombardment confirmed the severe damage that the lethal 14-inch shells had inflicted on the runways, parked aircraft, and airfield installations. The communication trouble we were having with our aircraft was in our own VHF and HF sets. The problem persisted, and before long we had to turn control of our combat air patrol over to Howe. Although the operation was having significant local success, it did have a larger strategic problem. It meant a significant number of the British Pacific Fleet's heavy anti-aircraft platforms, and crucially some of the most modern radar, and the operating crews to go with it, were not with the carrier fleet. And so when the Japanese counterattacked about an hour after the bombardment force had left formation with the carriers, some of the enemy would be able to get through, although it did take them some considerable effort and a bit of sneakiness. First, four small formations began closing in from the west. One of these began to circle the fleet towards the south, and so some of the Combat Air Patrol was sent to deal with it. With attention focused on tracking that group and the remaining three off to the west, but with the aforementioned absence of some of the bigger ships and their radars, it seems that a fifth group of aircraft had approached shortly thereafter from a different angle, and it was hypothesized from low level, as at about 11:30, lookouts spotted Japanese aircraft diving out of the low cloud cover right above the fleet. 10 aimed itself for the carrier Formidable, which had 11 Avengers being moved around the flight deck at the time. The carrier, and indeed the entire formation, made a series of evasive turns, and the first enemy approach was forced to turn into a strafing run. It wasn't ideal, but it wasn't awful either. But then the pilot swung the aircraft up and around in a climbing turn, realigning his approach vector before diving straight towards the carrier. Anti-aircraft guns pummeled it, but it was already in a terminal dive, which meant the 20mm hits just meant it arrived preemptively on fire, and it was also carrying what seemed to be a 500-pound bomb, which exploded on impact, obliterating the Japanese aircraft in the explosion. Another Zero moved to try and exploit the situation, but some of the remaining Combat Air Patrol Seafires had been informed of the incoming attackers shortly after it had started raining Japanese aircraft, and they managed to chase down the second Zero and blow it apart before it could reach its target. Formidable's armoured flight deck did most of the job that it was designed to do, keeping the bulk of the explosion itself out in the open, but a large splinter, displaced by the force of the impact and the explosion both, shot down through the ship, severing steam pipes in the central boiler room and puncturing a fuel oil tank. The leaking steam meant the centre machinery spaces had to be evacuated, and the carrier's speed would therefore be reduced to a maximum of 24 knots until that situation could be remedied. Up top, one of the Avengers was blown over the side by the explosion, another was set on fire, and the remaining nine were damaged by a combination of the strafing run, the explosion, and then the subsequent shrapnel. However, the port and starboard propellers were still online, and so the ship turned to allow the wind to blow much of the fire and smoke away from the damage control crews. Soon, a mildly irritated member of the hangar crew then phoned the bridge to report that water and firefighting foam that was being sprayed liberally on the flight deck was leaking through into his nice clean hangar, through blown rivet holes and a slightly opened up seam between two armour plates, and so a combination of wood and concrete was brought in to fill the dent in, and then a welder showed up with some thin sheet steel to cover the entire thing once it was roughly levelled. This meant that flight operations were actually declared open again by 5 in the afternoon, with total casualties being 8 killed and 47 wounded, although a handful of the wounded would later die of their wounds in the subsequent weeks. Now, all that remained was to sort out the broken steam lines and then find an electrician to reconnect an awful lot of cabling, as the blast and shrapnel that had hit the island had severed the power and data cables to all but one of the ship's radar arrays. The aircraft that Formidable already had aloft would initially have to recover to other carriers, but they'd be able to filter back in over the next few days. By 2 a.m. on the 5th, about 14 hours after the initial impact, the steam had been successfully vented from the central boiler room, access regained with judicious use of some hammers, the steam pipes had been fixed, the boilers had then been relit, and come dawn the ship was actually operating on full power again, albeit that the repairs were of course of a temporary nature and would eventually need some dockside work to make permanent. While Formidable had been under attack, another pair of kamikazes had gone after the Indomitable. One of those was lit up by 20mm Oerlikons, and although thoroughly perforated, the light anti-aircraft guns simply didn't have the firepower to cause it to physically break up, and it looked like the plane would just keep falling anyway into the deck. But at the last minute, the gunners must have hit something important, either severing or possibly jamming a control cable, or maybe even hitting the pilot as the aircraft began to pull up. Well, either that or the pilot thought his dive was going to fall a little bit short, but in any case it resulted in the plane crashing into the flight deck, but at a slightly shallower angle. Now, against an Essex-class's flight deck, that still would have been enough for it to penetrate through into the hangar, but against the thick armour of Indomitable's deck, it meant the plane just slid along under its own power before the rebound sent it sailing over the side to explode harmlessly in the sea. A few radar aerials were the only casualties, and some of the crew soon had to be dissuaded from collecting souvenirs made up of the various broken bits of aircraft left trailed across the deck, as that and a few paint scrapes were pretty much all the evidence that the hit had even occurred. Another kamikaze appeared shortly thereafter, but this one was far enough away when it was hit that it crashed into the sea nearby. A sailor aboard Formidable wrote, "Evidence of our second Japanese casualty was one eye, picked up by a rating with a strange sense of humour. It was put in a matchbox which he would suddenly push open in front of unsuspecting messmates. We landed on a strike shortly afterwards. They had taken temporary refuge in Victorious, and continued much as if nothing had happened. Admiral Vian signalled, well extinguished, any fomite left? And it was gratifying to get from Uganda our sincerest admiration. It was surprising to find that the crew of the pom-pom that had been engulfed in flames were actually quite all right. Anti-flash gear was made of uncomfortably hot material, but it was good to have such evidence of its efficiency. Not so reassuring was the plain fact that our Orlikan simply did not have sufficient physical stopping power. Both our opponents were hard hit, but came on, possibly aided by the freezing of control surfaces at high speed. The new Implacable, we'd heard, had a quadruple Bofors gun of large calibre, and we hoped for something similar to be installed when we were next in Sydney. By mid-afternoon, the battleships and cruisers had returned, and the radar and anti-aircraft gun net was complete once more. Between this and the active combat air patrol, several further enemy attacks were repulsed, with a final effort at 17:20, seeing every single attacker shot down by sea fires before they even got into the fleet's anti-aircraft range. One Royal Navy officer would later recount, "The American carriers didn't have armoured flight decks in those days. They had the ordinary light wooden deck and steel sheeting. One of the reasons I suspect they never followed our pattern being that, in hot weather, waltzing about on 3.75 inches of steel gets very bad on the feet. We reckon that the maximum heat time occurred about 3 to 4 in the afternoon, and so my commander, Eyre, amused himself one day by breaking an egg onto the flight deck at that time. It was lightly fried, not really to an edible condition, in about 7.5 minutes, and that's what you had to walk about on. But the result was that when a kamikaze hit an American carrier, it was about 3 months' dockyard job, and in the case of hitting a British carrier, you took a couple of brooms and swept the rubbish over the side. A great friend of mine, an ex-pilot who was a liaison at the American headquarters in Honolulu, told me that at a daily staff meeting one morning, the first kamikaze attack on a British carrier, the Formidable, was reported. The end of her signal said, expect to be back in action by 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The American staff around the table more or less lay back and roared with laughter, saying, ah, those British again. Next morning, when they heard she was back in action at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, they changed their tune rather rapidly. Follow-up strikes on the Japanese airfields on the 5th reported significantly less anti-aircraft opposition and an awful lot of big craters where some of those anti-aircraft guns had been the day before. The Japanese air efforts appeared to have expended themselves for the moment as well, as the only action was a reconnaissance aircraft that was shot down by Combat Air Patrol Corsairs. On the evening of the 5th, the fleet drew away for refueling, Formidable's crew taking the chance to put some fine finishing touches on their deck patch to make it nice and level. And with the practice of the previous operation, the fleet was back on station on the 8th, the day that Germany surrendered half a planet away. Poor weather meant that there was nothing much of interest happening, but on the 9th, things were a little bit better, and airstrikes were able to undo any repairs the Japanese had made to their airfields over the past few days. In the late afternoon, a low-level enemy formation was detected coming in at close range as it crossed the radar horizon. The Combat Air Patrol shot down most of it, but a handful of aircraft made it through, this time heading right for Victorious. The first to come in was shot up by Orlikans, but still managed to crash into the forward flight deck, knocking out the ship's catapult, one of the 4.5-inch anti-aircraft guns, and damaging one of the forward elevator's motors, which left it operational but somewhat slower. Apart from this, a small dent in the flight deck was the only other thing that was observed shortly before a second aircraft crashed into a group of Corsairs which had been ranged on the aft of the ship before the attacks had begun. Once again hit and on fire but not stopped, this kamikaze ploughed through four of the Corsairs, but then bounced clean off the flight deck armour and pinwheeled off into the sea. Two more kamikazes had survived the combat air patrol, and one of them seemed to decide to go after Victorious, but then changed its mind and went after the battleship Howe instead. Howe violently disabused the pilot of this notion, and its heavy anti-aircraft fire seems to have killed the pilot, as the aircraft approached in a shallow glide that then just coasted over the ship's stern before the aircraft eventually crashed into the sea. The last kamikaze went after Formidable, then changed course to go after the Indomitable. This time, however, anti-aircraft fire might have been a little bit too effective, as after stitching up the kamikaze, it made a sudden violent swing just as it came past Formidable. Some thought this was from a major structural failure, like a wing being blown off. Others thought maybe the pilot was still somehow alive and had regretted his last-minute course change. But either way, the kamikaze crashed into Formidable's deck park. This took out 18 of the aircraft that she'd been about to launch, but did little else to the ship. Within an hour, once hoses had put out the fires and various long sticks had prodded the broken aircraft out of the way, she was operational again. But the cumulative losses to her air group meant that she only actually had 15 operational aircraft left. Admiral Rawlings elected to summon the US escort carriers back to take his place briefly while the fleet sailed for the resupply and rendezvous point, where the wounded could be offloaded and the resupply fleet's escort carriers could restock his air groups. While this was being done, the British Pacific Fleet decided to change its tactics. Since the kamikazes had decided high-level attacks weren't working, they'd switched to low-level operations, which meant even radar had only picked them up at almost the last minute. Therefore, two destroyers would be placed as radar pickets in the direction that the enemy seemed to generally be coming from, each with their own combat air patrol formation under their direct control. This would allow the fleet to see and engage incoming low-level strikes further out, while also allowing the main combat air patrol, above the fleet, to only need to engage aircraft that leaked through the first set of defences, and it would also mean that combat air patrol was available just in case those first attacks happened to be decoys. The Dido-class anti-aircraft cruisers that were with the fleet were also moved much closer to the carriers, and a destroyer was positioned right astern of each carrier in order to add firepower in this arc, as most of the successful attacks had come from this direction. Finally, when a heavy air attack was confirmed, the battleships of the remaining cruisers would then close to within 2,000 yards of the nearest carrier to allow their own anti-aircraft batteries to cover the carriers with essentially every weapon right down to the Orlikans, right up until the very last moment. This effort was punctuated by the news that USS Bunker Hill had been badly hit off of Okinawa, with well over 600 casualties, almost 400 of which had been fatal. It was a sobering reminder of what could happen at any moment. However, while they were refueling, Admiral Weston observed, "To me, the most astonishing part of the whole operation was the complete failure of the enemy submarines to attack our oilers and fleet train, upon which everything depended. While on passage, a collection of slow but valuable repair and supply ships was wont to steam at about 10 knots, screened by only half a dozen small escorts. What would the U-boats have done to such a target?" But on the 12th of May, the fleet was back on station and airstrikes resumed. But the Japanese seemed to have temporarily run out of aircraft, and so aside from the inevitable operational losses and a few aircraft damaged or shot down by anti-aircraft guns, the British Pacific Fleet operated relatively uninterrupted, with strike aircraft expanding their list of targets to include troop convoys, that is, convoys of Japanese troops moving on land, coastal shipping, and basically anything that moved and looked vaguely hostile. At least that is, until the 18th, when an accident occurred aboard Formidable while the fleet was refueling once again. Admiral Rawlings looked out over the sea and noticed smoke rising from the carrier, later writing, "At 11:04 HMS Formidable was observed to be on fire. This proved to have been caused by a Corsair in the hangar accidentally firing its guns into an Avenger. The latter exploded. Fighting this serious fire was made difficult by the fact the fire curtains were out of action due to the earlier enemy suicide attacks. Only extensive use of the saltwater sprays succeeded in dousing the fire, but the cost was high. Exploding ammunition and fire, along with the saltwater, would leave 7 Avengers and 21 Corsairs in conditions varying from complete loss to a flyable but otherwise dud. By the evening, the commanding officer reported that he considered his ship capable of operating with jury lighting in the hangar to replace the normal circuits which had been destroyed in the fire. Arrangements were, therefore, made to replace her damaged aircraft as far as possible and for the ship to continue operations, at any rate for the next strike cycle. Admiral Spruance had indicated the British Pacific Fleet's effects on the Japanese airfields in the Sakishima area had been highly effective, and that therefore, after the 25th, he was happy to release the fleet for a while. So now Admiral Rawlings concentrated on making sure that enough temporary repairs and fresh aircraft were brought aboard to last out the coming week, although he also determined that if enough spare aircraft could be found, he would try and keep going until the end of the month. The weather on the 20th proved to be a mixture of rain and fog. HMS Quilliam, a destroyer, went to take up station next to the Indomitable, but, unknown to them until pretty much the last moment, the fog in that particular patch of sea thickened, dropping visibility considerably further than even the rest of the fog. And, well, what happened as a result is best described by her captain. There, dead ahead, loomed a dark cliff, close but indistinct, through what I now realised was exceptionally dense fog. Full astern together, hard aport, there was the clang of reply gongs and we sensed the revolutions building up, and then we hit. None of us on the bridge that day will ever forget what our eyes told us was happening. We saw our stem cleave straight into Indomitable's side and bury itself back to the muzzle of a gun. We felt so stunned by this apparition, for apparition thank God it was, that we hardly noticed the scream of tearing plates that accompanied it, and it was not until much later that I felt the pain of 2 broken ribs. Then, suddenly, all was quiet. We lay dead in the water, in a lifeless blanket of fog, alone as the Ancient Mariner. No sound, no sight, no feeling. The feeling was numbed. I stopped the engines. I thought of Indomitable. She won't sink. She can't sink, can she? But I must have almost cut her in half. And where are my bows? I can't have left them in her. So ran my thoughts. And then light dawned as I saw that the forecastle deck, where it ended, was curving downwards. We'd actually hit her in the armour, and the flare of her side had deflected our stem downwards and to port, and the rest of the wreckage had followed it out of sight. When the fog lifted, we were alone in the wide Pacific as the sun rose on a glassy sea. I could hardly believe my ears when I heard on the TBS a message from Indomitable reporting, "No damage." I learned later that the paymaster commander's looking glass was cracked and that he was considerably annoyed by this. The destroyer HMAS Norman tried to tow Quilliam home, but the drag of the damage and bent bows made this rather difficult, and since the Japanese lack of aircraft appeared to be a continuing issue, the cruiser Black Prince was dispatched to take over the tow. A few more strikes were launched through breaks in the weather, but the next few days offered variations on that theme as far as the weather was concerned. Aircraft would be sent off when cloud and fog permitted, with flight operations closing down if visibility became too bad. And nothing of enemy air forces was seen except for a lone C-6N Mert recon aircraft, which was shot down at 26,000 feet by a hard-climbing combat air patrol fighter. On the 21st of May, signals were received from Admiral Halsey, indicating that when Okinawa was done and he took over from Admiral Spruance in preparation for direct attacks on Japan, he would be integrating the British Pacific Fleet into the Third Fleet as a particularly overstrength task group, although as a courtesy, it would still be referred to as a task force. He'd been following the reports closely and with great interest, and had been impressed enough that he was willing now to put the British Pacific Fleet right up on the front lines with the rest of the US Fast Carrier Task Force. Given this, Rawlings decided to accept Spruance's 25th of May release date in order to get his ships repaired, restocked, and rearmed to the maximum possible back in Australia before heading to the Japanese coast. As Formidable had the most damage, she was released on the 23rd of May to get a head start on repairs. Two more days of poor weather and occasional airstrikes followed, but the 25th turned out to be a nice clear day. Rawlings debated sending his battleships in to bombard targets again, even as practically every operational aircraft in the fleet headed off, but he elected in the end to stay close to the carriers, just in case. In the end, it turned out to be an overabundance of caution. The British Pacific Fleet appeared to have destroyed every single operational aircraft in the Sakishima area, or else the Japanese were being really, really good at hiding. Rocket-armed Fireflies found so little of interest over the Japanese airfields that they were instead sent after a small dock which had been identified as a possible suicide boat base by a reconnaissance Hellcat. The Japanese seem to have decided to try and build additional airstrips as their repair efforts on the existing ones couldn't keep pace with the craters that the British Pacific Fleet's Avengers kept putting in them. But so degraded were the Japanese defences that the submarine USS Bluefish, which had rescued a number of British pilots who'd been forced to ditch over the past weeks due to combat damage, decided to surface off the coast near Ishigaki one evening and launch a one-gun shore bombardment of the construction efforts, which she managed to accomplish without any reply from the enemy other than a lot of screaming and hiding. As the sun set on the 25th of May, the British Pacific Fleet thus began to withdraw. The first stop would be the resupply fleet, then Manus, and from there the force would disperse to various Australian ports for more extensive repair work. The battleship King George V and three destroyers broke off and headed for Guam, where the British and American senior admirals would confer on the next steps. As the fleet made its way south, they received a note of appreciation from the head of the Fifth Fleet. On the completion of your 2 months' operations as a task force of the Fifth Fleet in support of the capture of Okinawa, I wish to express to you and to the officers and men under your command my appreciation of the fine work you have done and the splendid spirit of cooperation with which you have done it. To the American portion of the Fifth Fleet, Task Force 57 has typified the great traditions of the Royal Navy. Spruance. Reporters based in both fleets seem to be equally impressed, with the New York Times reporting, American naval observers with the British Pacific Fleet agree that the spirit of aggressiveness of the men and aircraft is unsurpassed in any navy. No one is more anxious to get into battle than these men. Their morale is immense. A few days later, Halsey relieved Spruance and the Fifth Fleet became Third Fleet, which was of course to be the British Pacific Fleet's new home when it returned. During the course of its operations off Sakishima, the fleet had flown almost 4,900 sorties, dropped almost 1,000 tons of bombs, and lost 160 aircraft to all causes. Breaking that down a bit, 26 of those losses had been shot down in combat, 71 had been operational losses, of which no less than 61 were sea fires that had broken themselves on landing, 32 aircraft had been lost in various kamikaze hits setting them on fire, and of course 30 aircraft had been lost in the hangar fire aboard Formidable. More ships were coming to Australia from Europe to join up, and this was reported to include the new light carrier HMS Ocean, which had been fitted out as a full night carrier, with additional air search radar installed and an air group that was composed entirely of F6F5N radar-equipped Hellcat night fighters. Another new arrival, although one that arrived a bit sooner than the others, was the carrier Implacable, which had been working up off Australia while the rest of the fleet had been hitting Sakishima. And Admiral Rawlings decided to take her and a number of other new ships, along with some of the more intact veterans, to go and poke at the not-now-long-isolated Japanese base at Truk, to try and get the new pilots and ships some frontline experience. Implacable was carrying 80 aircraft, 48 Seafires, 11 Fireflies and 21 Avengers, with the Seafires experimenting rather successfully in the field of dive bombing to expand their utility beyond that of combat air patrol. Remarkably, a full day of repeated strikes on the island resulted in no casualties, including no broken sea fires, with the sole exception of a walrus, which was aboard the escort carrier HMS Ruler, which was along for the ride as a search and rescue platform, but then was sadly blown over the side when the carrier was hit by a sudden squall. The cruisers with the force then conducted some shore bombardment. The only black mark here was HMS Swiftsure, which proceeded to blanket a good portion of an entire island with 6-inch shells, hitting pretty much everywhere but where the target was, despite multiple corrections from an observation aircraft. After some bewildered investigation, it turned out that a cog had fallen out of her fire control computer, and this system was therefore giving wild and ever-changing outputs. Somebody was duly sent to hunt down the errant clockwork and make sure it was put back in place, and several days of operations ended with just a single aircraft lost to enemy ground fire. Welcome news also came in the announcement that, after much experimentation ashore, Indefatigable's air wing, who'd grown bored in Australia, had determined that a US 89-gallon drop tank originally designed for the P-40 Warhawk fighter had actually fitted rather nicely on a 500-pound bomb rack and could thus be used to extend the sea fire's short endurance up to a maximum of 4 hours flight time. With the P-40 generally having gone out of frontline service in 1944 and thus being almost extinct in the Pacific frontline by 1945, one Royal Navy officer determined that there was a large number of these tanks in a US Army Air Force store over in New Guinea. He thus secured the services of a ship, sailed off over there, and after a polite request that in no way, shape or form involved the transfer of a substantial amount of Navy issue rum, and no, you can't prove anything as all the paperwork was tragically eaten later on by a wild bunyip, he sailed back with many, many P-40 drop tanks. And the US depot's filing clerks determined that, tragically, all their predecessors must have been really incompetent and triple or even quadruple counted their stocks. And clearly they didn't actually have many of the otherwise useless drop tanks left in their inventory, as it turned out anyway. This completely unofficial modification to the Sea Fire turned out to be extremely useful for the rest of the war. But, for the moment, the British Pacific Fleet was rapidly being refitted. Halsey wanted them on the front line, and they were determined to be there as soon as humanly possible.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.